has the world's fastest growing economy. Economists say it could surpass the U.S. by 2020, but it might slow down this year. With more than 1.3 billion people, China is also the world's most populous country. Today's guest, Ann Lee, says the U.S. media and government regularly target China as a threat. But rather than viewing China's power in a negative light, she believes the U.S. can learn from its competition. Ann Lee is the author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China. What do you think the U.S. can learn from the world's fastest growing economy? And how do you measure whether a country like China is successful? How do you measure progress? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The Kenyan president, Mwai Kibaki, has called for calm after the International Criminal Court announced it's charging four senior politicians with crimes against humanity.
I appeal to everyone to remain calm and peaceful. Our great nation has had its share of challenging times. On these occasions, we have re-examined our national conscience and moved forward together. We continue to do so.
The accused include two presidential candidates, Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto. They're alleged to have been behind the violence that followed the 2007 election, during which more than 1,000 people died. Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto rejected the allegations. The European Union has approved some of the toughest sanctions yet against Iran in a bid to halt what they believe is Tehran's nuclear weapons program. The measures include a ban on imports of Iranian crude oil and the freezing of assets belonging to Iran's central bank. The European Union foreign policy chief is Catherine Ashton.
The purpose of sanctions is to put pressure on Iran to come back to the negotiating table. A message that I've sent consistently through as many channels as I possibly can. I hope that Iran will respond positively to the messages that we have sent and come back to the negotiating table.
In a joint statement, the leaders of France, Britain and Germany said they could not accept Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon. Iran says it isn't trying to and has threatened to block the Strait of Hormuz, a global oil route. The United States has welcomed the sanctions. The foreign ministers also agreed to suspend visa bans on leading politicians in Burma, including the president and cabinet members. The EU ministers said further political reforms by the civilian-led government would lead to a further easing of sanctions. A protester has been killed in a clash with police in an ethnically Tibetan part of China, in which activists say Chinese security forces opened fire in a crowd. The reported incident came at a time of great tension in Tibetan-inhabited parts of China, as Viv Marsh reports.
Tibetan rights groups quoted eyewitnesses as saying the shooting happened in Sichuan province after several thousand people marched on government offices in Drago in support of Tibetan freedom. The demonstration was apparently prompted by arrests earlier on Monday, connected with the distribution of leaflets calling for Tibetan freedom. The official Chinese news agency confirmed one death, but didn't mention any shooting. It said a crowd had gathered after a rumour that a monk would set himself on fire. It said the crowd later attacked a police station with clubs and stones.
BBC News. The first Egyptian parliament, elected since the downfall of President Hosni Mubarak a year ago, has been holding its inaugural session. The parliamentarians chose Saad al-Qadatni, a leading member of the Muslim Brotherhood, as the speaker. Some of the new members of parliament, which is dominated by Islamists, improvised on the oath of office, adding pledges to God's law or to continue the revolution. Syria has vehemently rejected a new Arab League plan for ending violence in the country. Arab League foreign ministers have given the Syrian government 2 months to form a national unity government. They've also urged President Bashar al-Assad to hand over power to his deputy. Jim Muir is in neighbouring Lebanon.
From Syria's point of view, this is, as they say, a blatant interference in their affairs. In theory, President Assad has launched what he calls a reform process, which should again, in theory, see elections in the coming months for a multi-party system, which theoretically could mean him having to stand down. So he's seeing this new prescription from the Arab League, whereby he's supposed to devolve powers to his vice president. It's very much the template adopted by the Gulf in their peace initiative in Yemen, which is actually bearing fruit right now, with President Saleh actually flying out of the country to Oman and basically staying abroad.
Reports from Libya say fighters supporting the late leader Muammar Gaddafi are battling with militia loyal to the country's governing National Transitional Council in the town of Bani Walid. At least four people have been killed. Bani Walid was one of the last pro-Gaddafi bastions to fall in Libya's eight-month civil war. The South African youth leader Julius Malema has appealed against his five-year suspension from the governing party, the African National Congress. His lawyers told the ANC's appeals panel the decision did not follow the party's procedures. Once a close ally of President Jacob Zuma, Mr. Malema is accused of spreading division in the ANC. BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. China has become a major player in the global economy with a 9% annual growth rate in GDP over the last decade. U.S. economists believe that the world's second largest economy might slow this year, but there's no doubt that China is quickly surpassing the U.S. And things are rapidly changing in China. Many people are now living in China's cities than in the countryside. Along with Russia, China has become a major voice in challenging the U.S. military's involvements in Iraq and the sanctions against Iran, a major supplier of oil to China. China has also been criticized for its human rights record, its policy towards Tibet, and its treatment of its ethnic and religious minorities. According to a recent NPR piece, income inequality is staggering, corruption is systemic, and public protests are now a daily occurrence. Today's guest, Anne Lee, says the U.S. media and government regularly target China as a threat. But rather than viewing China's power in a negative light, she believes the U.S. can learn from its competition. Anne Lee is author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China, an open-minded guide to treating our greatest competitor as our greatest teacher. Anne is a senior fellow at the public policy think tank Demos. She also teaches finance and economics at New York University, and she was formerly a professor at Pace University, and she joins us in studio. Hi, Anne. Happy New Year.
Hi, thank you.
And Happy New Year to our Chinese and Chinese American listeners. We didn't actually book this show to coincide with the New Year, but here we are. So why don't we talk a little bit about, we'll dive in and talk about what you think the U.S. can learn from China. You lay out a number of things, but what would you say is at the top of your list?
Well, I wrote this book because there are a portfolio of ideas that all reinforce each other. If I had to just summarize one thing, I would say that the U.S. needs to learn to keep an open mind in order to continue to reform itself and to come up with solutions for very intractable problems. The reason why China is growing as dynamically as it is, after a period where they were considered a backwater country, was because Deng Xiaoping and other leaders then didn't give up their dream of making China a strong country, were able to depart from the ideology of just communism and were open to ideas from capitalism and be able to incorporate different ways of doing things and learning from results. And this way, they were able to gradually put China on the right track. And I'm suggesting to Americans and other citizens around the world that oftentimes we get conditioned to think a certain thing. However, we need to revisit some of these assumptions sometimes, because those assumptions may no longer be true. And it's that process of questioning and of being critical of various things that you hear from the media or from other folks that will enable you to realize well, what is the core problem and how do we fix this?
So what would you say are some of these big assumptions? Because you write about this regularly in your book, that the U.S. media and the government regularly target China as a threat. What stands out for you? What do you hear the most that bothers you?
Let's take the military threat, for instance. Obama recently said they're going to redeploy our military towards Asia Pacific. We see articles out of the New York Times and other places saying, oh, China's building a carrier. What are their military designs? Quite frankly, if you look at the facts, we outspend China over 10 times per year in the military. We spend over $1 trillion per year in the military. And China's military spending is about $90 billion. Even if you don't believe the official numbers, the unofficial highest guess of how much they spend from our own Department of Defense says they spend perhaps $150 billion. That is still so small compared to the U.S. Not only that, the U.S. has hundreds of military bases all over the world. China doesn't even have one. So what kind of threat are we talking about? And there is no reason why China would ever face us down on a military threat, because they're selling us goods. Why would they block their own ships from shipping goods to us? It makes no sense.
And so you think that one is being perpetuated in this country?
Sure, because we're talking about having budget cuts. Our military hasn't had any budget cuts for decades. And suddenly, we have no major threat in the world. We no longer have a Cold War with the Soviet Union. We killed Osama bin Laden. Kim Jong-il in North Korea is dead. The guy out of Saddam Hussein's gone. I mean, if you look around the world, there is no real major threat in the world. And so they need to invent a new threat. And this is some of the assumptions that I'm basically asking people to question, because just because you hear it a lot doesn't mean it's true.
What are some of the other ones? What are some of the other assumptions?
Well, I guess the other assumption is that China is going to be the next superpower and run us over economically. They're far from that. They're still a poor country. Our GDP per capita is still many times larger. I think ours is about 45,000, while their GDP per capita is roughly 4,000. So again, we're 10 times richer than China.
According to a new report on income inequality from Oxfam, China now has at least as many billionaires as the United States, and also has more than 200 million people living on less than a dollar a day. So major, major income inequality.
Absolutely, but we had it too. Any nation that goes through industrialization, you can look through history, you're going to see how some people will become very rich and other people need to catch up.
Well, we have income inequality here right now in this country.
Absolutely.
So the economy is the big one here. What on the economy, you write about, so you were born in Hong Kong, right? And you left at what age to come to the U.S.?
I was close to eight.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the changes that you've seen in China on the economy, and how do you really explain this explosion that we've seen in China?
Sure. The country has gone through this explosion in just the last three decades because the leaders there recognized that they needed to figure out a way to incorporate the talents of millions and hundreds of millions of people there. Before, they were suppressing it because they had their priorities, their ideology of, oh, we just need to make China strong. Let's just build a nuclear weapon or whatever it is, and not incorporating the skills of all the people around them and what their natural competitive advantages would be. Once they figured out how to do that, that was when the country was able to grow dynamically. And I suggest in my book that the United States is not incorporating all the talent that we have here to productive use.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I know lots of very talented entrepreneurs. They can't get access to any capital to put their ideas into reality. If they could, we could generate lots of jobs.
Well, the banks aren't lending them money. That's the problem.
Absolutely. It's a problem. And there's many different obstacles to this. And I discuss it in my book, how when you have established entrenched powers in certain industries, they'll create laws that create an uneven playing field so that it's very difficult for new ideas to surface and create new jobs. So this idea of creative destruction that the economist Schumpeter talked about isn't really happening here.
So, but talk about what that means in terms of how China has really just gotten so big and powerful over the years, because you really, it's hard to find things these days that are not made in China, right? We were just talking before the show that just about everything at Walmart is made in China. Most goods are made in Shenzhen. Most people probably have never even heard of the city Shenzhen. But how do you see that playing out? Because that's the fact, that there are millions of people in Chinese factories making goods that are shipped to the United States. How is that affecting both economies?
Well, it's actually benefited both economies, because the U.S. Was able to make record profits while they were working with China. Nike, who makes shoes in China, China only gets 10 cents per shoe. Nike gets to charge $200, so they get the lion's share of the profit, and this money gets spread around to Americans in marketing, in the legal department, in the accounting department, so on and so forth. So a lot of Americans benefited by having China as a partner. Yes, we hear about manufacturing jobs being lost, but if it weren't being outsourced in China, in fact, those manufacturing jobs probably wouldn't have existed here anyway, because they would have used machinery to make a lot of the products, because it's a cost-benefit analysis. If it's cheaper to use cheap labor, they'll use the cheap labor. If it's cheaper to use machines, they'll use machines. And so it was a false choice that politicians posed to the American people. What we need to do really is take the people who lost their jobs in manufacturing, retrain them so that they can work in a 21st century economy. And ours has moved, you know, higher up in the food chain in terms of becoming a more knowledge-oriented economy. That's what our nation needs to do. But in terms of both economies got to profit by this economic partnership.
We're talking with Anne Lee. She's author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China. And I'd love to hear from you on this. What do you make of the growth of China? Why do you think China has grown so quickly over the last couple of decades? What do you make of China's place in the world? And how did China end up being the second largest economy in the world? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. As you noted, the multinationals are the ones that make the massive profits here, and the workers are the ones that are doing the work for pennies. According to the anti-poverty group War on Want, despite its rapid growth, more than 482 million people live on less than $2 a day. To escape extreme poverty, many migrants from the countryside have moved to industrial cities. There are about 136 million workers in China. On average, the migrants work 12 hours a day, 26 days a month. They earn about $140 a month. Living conditions are poor, with six people sharing a small, cramped room. According to this group, the majority of workers do not have written contracts, and job security is exacerbated by the government's failure to enforce national labor standards. You didn't really address human rights issues in your book.
I explain in my book that I understand there are lots of things that are wrong about China. And like any nation, it has its weaknesses and strengths. I explain in the beginning of the book that if we only dwell on the weaknesses, we miss an opportunity to learn from the strengths. And in my book, I said, I'm just going to focus on this one area, because even though the U.S. is a strong wonderful nation. It is still not perfect. We still have room to improve ourselves. And obviously, if China was able to grow this rapidly, they were doing something right. What is it? And so these ideas that the leaders put together are the ones I talk about in my book. And I'm suggesting that some of these ideas can be modified. If we take these elements and apply it to a democratic capitalist society, we can make our economy more dynamic as well.
How do you think labor unrest will play out in China? Because there are now protests on a regular basis. A couple of weeks ago, a number of workers at the Foxconn factory, which makes products for Apple, Microsoft, Dell, Sanyo, you name it, they threatened to commit suicide because their working conditions are so bad. These specific workers are putting together the Xbox for Microsoft. And then last year, things got so bad that Foxconn put netting around their building in case people jumped, which is so hard to even fathom. So how do you see that playing out?
I think they're going to make the reforms to protect worker rights, just like it happened here in the United States, just like, you know, child labor was eliminated in England, but Charles Dickens wrote about it. And so whenever nations go through industrialization, yes, there are going to be environmental abuses. Yes, there are going to be labor abuses. And while it took hundreds of years for Western nations to get through all these issues, I think it's only going to take maybe a couple decades for China to. So I believe that the Chinese leaders recognize these issues and will treat it very seriously and will devote more of their resources to enabling the regulators to crack down on labor abuses. So I expect that this will follow the same trajectory as the United States.
Anne Lee is a senior fellow at the public policy think tank Demos, and her new book is What the U.S. Can Learn from China. We've got full lines, so let's hear from Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid.
Hi. Good morning. I couldn't disagree totally with anybody in my life as I disagree with this lady. She's, I'm sorry to say, a propaganda machine for China. The fact is China totally destroyed the U.S. economy. You're dealing with slave labor, people working for cents a day, people committing suicide, where an average American worker was making $60 an hour 20 or 30 years ago, where most of them are unemployed. The China market was created by the new conservative stock market deal, where they cared more about how much the stock market make than how much the American people made. The fair trade was never fair. The free trade was never free. And as far as anything of any kind, I just catch this lady lying constantly and avoiding answering any question of substance that she asked herself. And the fact is, China not only threatened economically, they destroyed this country. The dumping stuff, a product. How can you buy a DVD for $10 from Walmart? And how do you buy all of this cheap made in China? Many of it's toxic. They poison cats, they poison dogs, they poison babies. The buck is the only master of China right now. And really, the American people have to stop whatever they can do buying stuff in China as much as they can. A lot of businesses destroyed in America, including mine.
Let me just jump in here quickly, Eid, and let Anne know that Eid owned an electronics store over in Berkeley. So he's seen things drastically change over the past couple of decades.
I mean, before, when we were buying stuff from Japan, when we were selling VCR at $1,000 a piece, we sold as many as we can get. Now with this, you know, DVD made for $20, you may sell one or two every month. And the fact is, the margin is not there for stores. For middlemen, for upper men, the only people making money are the shark at the top, the Wall Street people, the 1%, and the Chinese billionaires. The rest of the Chinese people are victims just as much as the American people, and it's total collapse of the world economy, what China have done. And about 30% of Chinese product, whether it is electronic or other, are defective in the box.
Well, thank you for calling in. Let's get a response from Anne.
Sure, I understand his frustration because, like I said, we've heard of all the worst things about China. There are plenty of books that talk about that. And so my book is taking a different angle, right? Because if we only hear one side, we're not hearing the other side. But in regards to the economy, yeah, if Americans want to make sure that our corporations are not outsourcing manufacturing to China, they can say that to our policymakers and tell them to create laws to say, No, if you want the benefits of being a U.S. corporation, then you have to follow certain rules. It's up to us to tell our politicians to make the laws that forbid our corporations to take advantage of cheap labor in China or India or Bangladesh or anywhere, right? So it is within our ability to make sure we don't have a race to the bottom. But to just scapegoat China for that because they, you know, have a lot of labor and are being taken advantage of by multinationals, you know, that is not a productive conversation. We are not overlords over China. The Chinese have their Chinese leaders, and they're going to protest to their leaders. We need to discuss productive reforms with our leaders.
Well, thank you for calling in, Eid. Let's take a few more calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for an informative program. My view of this whole thing is mixed. First of all, I think when it comes to human rights, there is something happening in Tibet, in my view, that's unconscionable. And it seems to me that people are being turned into a minority in their own country, and the consequences are appalling for the Tibetans. Having said that, it seems to me, though, that if you compare the human rights record of China, using as a reference what happened under Mao Zedong, I think there's been a vast improvement. And the other point that I'd like to make is it has to do with the question of inequality in China. There are serious problems. As mentioned, there is labor unrest, and these are very positive developments. But you have to keep in mind that if I were to quote the American economist Stiglitz, according to him, 500 million Chinese people have been pulled out of poverty as a result of the enormous economic progress that they've experienced in the last 30 years. In addition, as to the trade imbalance between the U.S. and China, much of that has to do with intra-company trade involving the American branches of American companies operating in China. So the onus is on us to some extent to deal with that, but we can't just blame the Chinese for what's happening here. I will stop here. I think it's. I thank you for a very good program. And I'll quote the former prime minister of China, Zhou Enlai. When asked about the French Revolution, he said, well, it has been 200 years. It's too early to tell. Likewise, I'd like to propose that we can say the same thing about the Chinese Revolution. Mm. It's a work in progress. There is a lot that needs to happen. And it's good that we should put pressure on them. That's fair enough. But I'll stop here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Max. He brought up a number of points, Anne. Which one would you like to address?
Well, I'll take the Tibetan situation. A lot of people here hear that one side of the Tibetan story, and I'm not going to apologize for China's side. However, I will say that it is not the complete story that most Americans get. Tibet was actually a slave society, and China basically said to them, we need you to get rid of slavery. In exchange, we will pay all your monks a salary, and you can pray and do whatever you want, all you want, but we're going to get rid of this system that you have here. And basically, they had agreed to it, and so why they have, you know, these people who are fighting for the original system, I haven't interviewed those people. But this is particularly interesting because when I was teaching at Peking University, it was very clear when you see the Chinese side of what's going on in Tibet, and you see that the police that are trying to stop these Tibetans from burning down the stores and the homes of the Han Chinese who live there, these are actually Tibetan police who are basically stopping their own people from creating all this massive destruction and violence. And so that's why I basically am saying that we need to understand both sides of the story before we jump to conclusions.
Well, we're going to break, but we do have, it's just been reported that there's a new violence reported in a restive Tibetan area of Western China. I just got a New York Times report on this, and we'll talk more about it after the break. We're talking today with Anne Lee about her new book, What the U.S. Can Learn from China. And we'd love to hear from you. How do you explain the rapid growth that we are seeing in China? How did it end up being the second largest economy in the world? Some economists say it might surpass the U.S. by 2020, but it will likely slow down this year. 866-798-8255. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you haven't visited KALW.org lately, it has changed a lot. The redesign is aimed to make it easier for you to find the information you want and for you to be able to share the programming you value on KALW with people you know. It is a work in progress, however, and we need your help to make it even better. Please check out the new KALW.org, see what you think, and send us any suggestions you have for improvements. Thanks for listening to and supporting KALW, both on the air and online at KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find out more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment there on our new website and find out what's happening in the coming days. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the Stop Online Piracy Act. It is off the table for now. It doesn't mean that it's not going to come back, perhaps under a different name and completely restructured. But we will talk about how this got on the table in the first place and what's really in store for the future of information on the internet. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by Anne Lee. She's author of the book, What the U.S. Can Learn from China. She says that the U.S. media and the government regularly target China as a threat, but rather than viewing China's power in a negative light, she says the U.S. can learn from its competition. And Anne is a senior fellow at the public policy think tank Demos. She also teaches finance and economics at New York University. And she's speaking tonight at UC Berkeley at 7 o'clock. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And before we move on, I just wanted to bring up, we got a couple calls about Tibet. People saying, what about self-determination? And what happened today, security forces opened fire on Tibetan protesters in Western China, injuring at least 32 people, killing at least one. According to the New York Times, it's the largest violent confrontation in ethnic Tibetan areas of China since 2008. This is according to two Tibetan rights groups and the Tibetan exile government. So what are your thoughts on this? And what about the self-determination in Tibet?
Well, I think it's a complex issue. I'm not going to take sides on this one. But I guess if we want to make an analogy, we went in militarily and took over Hawaii. This whole country was about violently taking over the land from the Indians and from the Mexicans. And so who's right? We are dealing with power politics most of the time,
right? When you hold up the U.S. as an example, then your standards are pretty low because this country has a very bloody past, right? So you tended to do that a lot in your book, and I wasn't sure if kind of comparing to the U.S. was the best example because, I mean, you can find faults on almost every issue in this country. So if you compare it that way, then your standards seem pretty low.
No, what I'm saying is that every nation has their worst features and their strengths. I'm not apologizing for all the things that China does wrong. I really don't endorse their human rights actions at all. I hope that they continue to reform. I think that they're not going to be a strong nation unless they continue to make reforms. So I don't endorse any of that in my book. And I say that, quite frankly.
But don't you think you can, in order to move forward, you have to deal with the negative aspects of a society, right? And that's why I felt like I wanted more from you on that, because you sort of, I felt like you just kind of brushed the human rights issue under the rug by not really bringing it out.
People already have pointed out these human rights issues, and I'm saying I agree with them. I am not trying to defend China on human rights issues. I think that all civilization needs to work harder at human rights. We can look at other democracies like India that violate human rights too. There's bride burning that goes on there. They have rampant prostitution where they import women from other nations like Nepal into India. So if you want to discuss human rights, there are plenty of violations all over the world.
We talk about them on a regular basis on this show.
Sure. And I'm saying, why do we want to dwell on all the weaknesses? We need to also look at the strengths to figure out how do we make things better.
Do you think it's important to give the poorest people in China a voice, the people that are being exploited?
Absolutely. Which is why I believe that I agree. I think they deserve much better treatment. And I think it's good that they're finally getting this attention. And this will motivate the central government to deal with the corruption that goes on in the local governments. And I explain in my book that there are basically two-tier government systems in China. In order to work for the central government in China, you have to take a competency test by the time you're 35. And if you don't, you stay in the private sector. This way, they try to minimize the conflicts of interest of the revolving door that happen here in the United States. And once you are in power in the central government, then you get rotated to different positions for five-year terms, and you can't serve anything for more than two terms. And during that time you're in a position, you have to prove to your nation how you are improving that particular organization that you are in charge of. So, for instance, if you are a university president, you then have to show during your tenure there how you increase the number of foreign exchange programs with other nations. Perhaps you had more graduates secure well-paying jobs under your leadership. So if they do well, they get promoted. Perhaps they get rotated to become mayor of another city. But if they don't do well, then they get demoted. And they have to do this for decades. They have to prove their entire career of creating positive change before they ever get considered for the top position.
However, what about the
local governments do not go through this system.
But it's a one-party system, though, right? So what about political participation?
The political participation basically is through whether they do a good job for their organization, their city, their province, right? Because if they don't do well, and the people, whether it's the students who are rating them, other professors, or the citizens, if they don't do well, then they get demoted. That's where the political participation comes. So this idea of earned authority, which is like a CEO having to work his way to the top, because you don't elect a CEO based on popularity, the person has to demonstrate they have the experience and the knowledge to be able to lead an organization.
But what about the workers participating and speaking out, like an organizer, without feeling like they're going to get fired or even worse?
No, I understand. And this is what I'm saying. This is a long process, and I was getting to that, because the local government officials, such as an official that runs, say, Redwood City or Foster City, these people are the most corrupt ones in China, where they take bribes and let the worker abuses happen. And so the central government is trying to figure out a way to get these people out of power, because they're not taking competency tests. They don't have to prove what they're doing. And they're trying to incorporate democracy in these areas into the villages where they can vote these people out. That's what China's experimenting with. And this is going to take time, because you're talking about a nation with over a billion people, and they have a lot of problems they need to deal with, this being one of them.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Marie-Louis. Hi, Marie-Louis. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I did get very upset when I heard the words about Tibet, and I think that slavery in Tibet, that was a pretty old thing. I have friends from Tibet. I don't think they're fighting for for Tibet because they were in slavery when they came, when they were there. So I think that was a strange kind of statement to make. And I think that with this kind, whenever something is brought up that needs to be improved, that needs to be changed, it is not to just down talk the nation or the people somewhere that are leading, that are doing these kinds of things. It is that we would like to see things improved. We don't want to see items coming from China that are dangerous to life, for animals or babies or anybody. So we fight for these things. We want to improve it. To keep comparing, well, you also, you took Hawaii back in time. This is not helping anybody. It's not to say that people think that United States had such a wonderful background, of course, with slavery and racism and all. No, very few people are trying to protect that. So it's disturbing to hear the guest be coming up with these ideas or speaking in this way. It's a little vague, and I think it would be more courageous to take another tone. So that's all I would like to say.
Thank you, Marie-Louise.
Thank you.
Anne, your response?
Well, I'm basically trying to say we got to see the big picture. When people are China bashing, I'm suggesting that...
But do you equate China bashing with talking about real concerns about workers' rights and workers' violations and what's happening to these millions of people who are making
less than I think it's legitimate.
$200 a month?
I am saying it is absolutely legitimate to be concerned about these people. However, I also point out that, yes, there are much worse offenses all over the world. There's genocide in parts of Africa.
But that doesn't excuse what's happening in China.
It doesn't excuse it. It doesn't excuse it. I'm saying that in my book, I'm not excusing it. I never said I was excusing it.
Well, let's just talk about China right now, because you tend to go to other countries on a regular basis.
I'm basically saying is that we all live on this global village called planet Earth, all right? We should care about everybody. And so if people just want to focus on China and just focus
on
what's
wrong... Well, that's not what we're saying, though, Anne. We've done many shows on this show about human rights abuses all over the world, including this country. But you wrote a book about what the U.S. can learn from China specifically.
Right. And so let's talk about what we can learn. But you want to focus on what they're doing wrong. And then you can't learn anything then.
But you can't learn without going back and looking at what you've done in your life that didn't turn out well. I mean, that's you're completely glossing over a lot of the human rights abuses. And how can you move forward without dealing with what these people are undergoing on a regular basis in these factories? How can you? What about the environment? I mean, there's so many different issues.
That's what I'm saying.
How do you move forward without dealing with those issues?
They are dealing with it. I'm saying that the Chinese leaders recognize and they're dealing with it. In their latest five-year plan from 2011 to 2015, they say they want to have a greener economy. How are they going to get there? They basically have specific performance targets they've attached to them. So, for instance, they want to reduce carbon emissions by 17% per GDP unit by 2015. They want to increase efficiency in buildings by 16% per GDP unit by 2015. Then the people who are in charge of those areas will then have the autonomy to come up with the right solutions to get to those targets. They welcome private sector into this process by providing tax incentives for people who have clean technology. They hike tax rates for the high polluting industries. So by having a combination of all these different ways, they will slowly move the nation into the right direction, which I would say is a really active reform when you're trying to steer a Titanic.
Well, let's go to our next caller. Let's hear it from Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Thanks for holding.
Hi, Rose. Hi, Ms. Lee. A interesting subject. Ms. Lee, you know, I find you to be the ultimate apologist from everything you've been saying. We've had a trade war with China. We lost. We imported over the past 11 years $1.2 trillion net of Chinese goods. We export almost nothing to them. Our trade deficit in 2010 was $273 billion with China. About one-fourth of those products, $80 billion or so, were very high-tech, sophisticated routers, iPhones, iPad, computers. China has eaten our lunch. And it's all because they exploit their workers, and our CEOs of the local companies here have no problem with that. 28% of our GDP used to be manufacturing in the 1950s. Now it's only 11%. China has destroyed the working people of this country. It has destroyed our nation. I find your book and you totally appalling. You are appalling. American, I've been out of work for 2 years. Do you know what that's like, lady? Do you have any idea what NAFTA and WTO have ruined? They've ruined this country. And we've been fighting the top 1% since Seattle. We are not getting anywhere. Our politicians don't listen to us, and you know we've tried. And with people like you against us, we have no
I am not
no
against you.
But to keep on fighting, but you're not on the you're not an American, my dear. You are.
Sir, I totally sympathize with your situation. I am all for the Americans. That's why I wrote this book, because I want the U.S. to be more dynamic. But if you want to look at the facts, the manufacturing dropped to 11% long before China came into the picture. It fell to that point in the 1980s when finance took over the economy. So if you want to look at raw facts, that's what's going on. And in fact, we export more to China than to any other nation. And so
What can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I actually wrote an article in the Huffington Post explaining and providing all the statistics on what's really going on. And so, you know, I don't have all those numbers on the tip of my tongue, but you can look at the article on Huffington Post to see. And the title is called World Without China. I do sympathize with him. I would love for the Americans to have a future and to get a job. What I'm saying is that we need to create the policies here in America because we have the power to do that. We have to have the willpower to make sure our politicians will do the right thing.
Well, a lot of people believe that because these corporations that have no allegiance to the U.S. are in the pockets of the politicians, they don't respond to U.S. workers.
Well, that's our problem we need to fix. This is our government. It's we the people, and so if this is a problem where lobbying dollars are influencing public policy, then the people need to come up with a way to counter that.
But here's what we're facing on the ground. I always use Foxconn as an example because it's so big and because workers there have committed suicide. A number of Foxconn workers are asking for raises, and so Foxconn, whose profits are not that big compared to Apple Computer, that's definitely a fact, are now saying that they might replace robots. They might replace the workers with robots.
Absolutely.
So that's our future.
Yep.
So what happens to those hundreds of millions of Chinese who left their villages to go to the big cities to work in these factories? And then what happens to China?
Well, they need to go back to school and learn new skills. Unfortunately, there's no simple answer to this, right? Because the only way to stay ahead of this incremental creep of technology that is replacing people is that you need to go and get new skills to come up with new ways of working. And it's not just in manufacturing. We've gotten rid of lots of secretaries because of Microsoft Office, right? There, people can just work on their own laptop. They don't need a secretary anymore. We don't need bank tellers because of ATM machines. You can look down the line, and technology is what's replacing most American jobs. And so we need to figure out how to re-educate, send people back to school to learn the right skills to deal with a 21st century future. And that is a big challenge. However, today, people who are unemployed, they can't go back to school to get new skills. If they go back to school, they can't collect an unemployment check anymore. So we have some policies in place that don't make any sense. And I'm suggesting that we need to address that. The fact that corporations can make profits overseas and don't get taxed if their profits are made overseas, but will get taxed if they bring their money back to the United States. Another problem that we have that is stopping investment from happening in this country to hire people. We need to change those policies here in our country. It has nothing to do with China.
Well, we've got just about 5 minutes left, so let's take a few calls in a row, and then we'll get a response. Let's go to Richard in Tiburon. Hi, Richard. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to go back to the environment. To me, that is irreversible. Some of these other things can be cured fairly quickly, but the environment and global change in climate, from what they are creating, the Chinese, from what I gather, is going to be irreversible, and it's going to affect the entire world. They're supposed to be building one power plant a day, which is kind of hard to conceive of. Of those, my understanding is the bulk of those are still coal-fired. At least, well, they're trying to change a Titanic slowly, but it's a Titanic they created rapidly in the last few years. So it seems like the priorities have been entirely to increase the economy and not pay enough attention to the environment, and the whole world is going to pay for that, is my concern.
Thank you. According to, let's see, arid northern China is drying out. The wet south is seeing more and more flooding. And according to Greenpeace, 80% of the Himalayan glaciers that feed Asia's mightiest rivers could disappear by 2035. And then the fact is that about 70% of the world's discarded computers and electronic equipment ends up in China, where it's scavenged for usable parts and then abandoned, polluting soil and groundwater with toxic metals, which obviously affect the people who live near these areas. Thank you for the call. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go to Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul.
Yes, I'd like to return to your question at the beginning of the program as to why we think China has become such a muscular, eat-our-lunch superpower. And I'm not worried about China as a military power, but I would like to say that if we had a country where, well, we have a country that is kind of similar to China. We have a corrupt government that is in the hands of the corporations. They have a corrupt government that owns the corporations. So they don't have to worry about going through the process, even if it's a phony one, of where to put a dam that will displace millions of people and put agricultural land underwater. They don't have to worry about a lot of things that we feel make us a civilized nation. And what's going on in Tibet is an absolute disgrace, and that your guest can defend this country and makes her home here and takes advantage of our country's freedoms is an absolute disgrace on her part, because she definitely has spent this whole hour defending China and apologizing for China, and not in a good way. Thank you.
Thank you. We're getting a lot of emails about Tibet, Anne. A lot of people are not happy with how you characterized the situation. But I just want to take a few more calls because people have been waiting patiently. Let's hear from Lee in San Francisco. Hi, Lee.
Hi. You know, I basically wonder why you haven't addressed the question of scale. I know you don't want people just picking on China and focusing on China, but the reason why we do is that things are happening there at such a volume and with such numbers that are overwhelming and unprecedented. So your constant defensiveness is completely illegitimate. You know, why don't there's so many positive things happening in China too, but nonetheless, these horrors that Foxconn and others exemplify are real. So stop being so defensive and address the real issues. Thank you.
Anne?
I've been trying to address the real issues, and I'm saying that, yes, we already know about these things. We know about the worst things about China. I'm not saying they don't exist.
So what do you think should be done to address these issues where workers are threatening to commit suicide, where they already committed suicide last year? What should be done to address that issue? They're making less than $300 a month, 16 hours a day. They're lucky if they get a day off. A lot of the workers say that they bend over just to take a break. They're not allowed to talk to their colleagues. What
yes,
should be done about that?
The Chinese should put in minimum wage laws, should put in laws to protect worker health. Absolutely. They need to put these things in. It's just that it takes time for them to be able to reach all these corrupt officials to make sure they get enforced. It's just like the environment. They had passed really great laws to protect the environment as early as 2006, but it was difficult for them to enforce them. And so when you have over a billion people, it takes time to ensure that there is compliance on everything. Just to give you an example, we have about one lawyer for every 200 citizens in the United States. They have about one lawyer to about 12,000 citizens. They have growing pains. No question. I understand the frustration that people are expressing about human rights and so forth. I completely agree with them. I completely understand, and I am not apologizing for China on these fronts. I'm saying that if you only focus on this, and I can tell that all your callers only focus on this and don't focus on, well, what can we possibly learn? Because this gigantic nation that has existed for centuries obviously had done some things right. And the fact that they lifted half a billion people out of poverty, obviously they did some things right, because there are lots of people in the Middle East, lots of people in Africa. They're still not experiencing the same dynamism. And so what are they doing right? And that is the point of my book. I'm trying to share with the Americans the things that we could use as best practices, because I'm not saying that China is perfect. The U.S. is not perfect. We're both imperfect nations.
Well, and NPR actually ran a piece recently that said a lot of wealthy Chinese are moving to the U.S. because they feel like the economy is totally volatile, and they feel like it's not stable. They want their children to go to school here. So there are a lot of complexities here.
There are complexities, I mean, but just as many people you say coming over here from China, I know plenty of Americans moving to China for jobs. In fact, many Europeans and Americans are going there because they can't get jobs here.
Well, so China, we have about a minute left. It's an export-oriented economy. A couple people wanted you to address that quickly. There's got to be a market for its goods outside of its own border. How will China adjust to this as the demand in other countries for these commodities decline?
They're trying to re-engineer their economy so that they become more of a consumer economy. They're already increasing consumption. The Economist reported that. And frankly, I think a lot of the consumer goods are being underreported in terms of consumption in China, because they tend to want to leave their country to purchase certain things because it's more expensive in China. And whenever they visit as tourists to the United States or to Europe, they buy very expensive goods there that they would never purchase in China, because the culture there is that they need to bring gifts back to their bosses, their teachers, their colleagues. And so all of this is not captured. And so as they're trying to move away from exporting and doing more domestic consumption, that's where they're going to create the market.
We have 20 seconds left. What else would you like to say about what the U.S. can learn about from China?
I would like to say that, yes, I understand that a lot of people are conditioned to hate China. We've heard it from our politicians. We've heard it from the media. I am not apologizing for China. I know there are a lot of things that go wrong, but we need to keep an open mind, because there are always two sides to every story.
Ann Lee is the author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China. She's speaking tonight at UC Berkeley at 7 o'clock. Find more information, yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow.
So
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malia Hayraz is on and Ellie Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and David Latudleep is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.